hppodcraft.com.
Greetings, ghouls and ghosts and goblins and Guy Fieri's. Welcome to the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and it's our comment show. Yay! Exclusively on Patreon.
We're going to talk about the things you talk about after listening to us talk about stories. Where do we last leave off?
We are picking up with In Amundsen's Tent.
Yes.
Lots of praise for Edward French and his reading. He is awesome.
Totally agree. He's such a nice guy, too. Don't forget to go check out his YouTube page, which has lots of full readings, and drop a note that you heard him on our show if you can. I'd like to ask him back again, and some positive feedback always helps with the persuasion.
Yes, it does.
I liked this comment about his reading in particular. Andrew Nisus writes, "This was the first time listening to the pod where I was literally too spooked to get out of my car when the story ended. Mr. French is too much!" And then he also added, "Granted, it was 11:30 p.m. after coming home from a drag show."
Oh.
Now, I would think that coming home from a drag show would have you filled with whatever the opposite of horror is, you know?
Yeah.
Delight, I suppose.
Joy?
Joy. So the fact that Edward French was able to overcome that feeling and change it into horror, that's really high praise. And also,
sure
I assume Andrew is still in his car because of what we did to him. But we're not legally responsible for that, are we?
Well, I'm going to have to talk with our legal department and find
out. Yeah, check with legal, would you? I don't... Sorry, Andrew, if you've died of some kind of dehydration by this point. Hopefully, you make it long enough to listen to this show and hear your comment.
Marcus Lauer writes... Go to the German Wikipedia page for Amundsen for a picture of the most ancient-looking 48-year-old you've ever seen.
Yeah.
I guess the polar climate will do that to you.
Boy, I did go and look at the photo, and he is sure right about that.
Yeah.
Amundsen looks like the warden in Shawshank Redemption after opening the Ark of the Covenant. That is the best way I can describe it. Check out the photo and you'll see what I mean. Jason Thompson writes, perhaps the most awesome moment in this story and the most Call of Cthulhu role-playing game moment is when they unload all their guns into the monster to kill it and it just wakes it up.
Yes.
So true. I wish we'd said that in the show.
That's good. Samwise Crider writes, interesting coincidence that Chris and Rachel will soon be viewing Is There in Truth No Beauty?, which could be considered another variation of this theme. Yes, that is a Star Trek episode where there is an ambassador that is so ugly, is the word they use, that if you see him, you go insane.
And does that play out in the episode?
Oh, yeah. They have to carry him around in a box, and Spock is the only one that could look at him, but even then, he still has to wear this visor to be able to look at it, to kind of filter out some of the stuff, some of the wave frequencies. It's pretty Lovecraftian, man.
That's cool.
It's really cool.
I don't remember that one.
Go check it out. It's a really good episode conceptually. It's a little slow in parts, but man, I keep talking about this. Maybe I brought this up. I'm going to bring it up again just in case. That the original series of Star Trek is super Lovecraftian almost every week, seriously, especially in the third series. They run into an omnipotent species or creature, some kind of crazy godlike thing, and they have to deal with it. I feel like in Next Gen, most of the time they deal with things that are about their level of tech or lower. The galaxy's full of these super intelligent, crazy things.
Clint Howard and whatnot.
Yeah, go back and watch the original series with a bit of a Lovecraftian lens on it, and I think you'll be surprised.
Eli Sheba writes that you have not launched a formal wear collection for dogs is disappointing me right now. Well, Eli Sheba, I guess you haven't been to JCPenney lately because the Good Boys and Bitches collection is on fire out on the floor. You know, before we jumped on here to record this episode, I was actually working on our new commercial for that line.
Okay.
Chris, I got here. Read this line for me. So we're two dog owners in a kitchen. Read this line.
Okay, sure. Bob, I don't know what to do. My dogs are looking cute, but they don't want to go outside. How can I improve their self-esteem?
Well, Jerry, it's time to tux those f**ks. Good Boys and Bitches, exclusively at JCP.
God.
I'm working on it.
Wow.
Yeah.
John Hancock writes, a fantastic reading, wonderfully atmospheric. Regarding Scott, there is a fair likelihood that what killed his team was scurvy, leaving them far too weak to push ahead as the weather deteriorated. A diet of pemmican, biscuit, and butter with some horse meat fell critically short in calories and vitamins.
Yeah.
Vitamins. I just said vitamins.
You sure did.
Vitamins. Oh, this country, it's getting to me.
Oh, no, you're transforming.
Oh, jolly good. Nobody up here says jolly good.
They don't.
I live in the north, so it's different.
Jacob writes, this and the fact that the British expedition was apparently tragically unprepared for the trip itself, that is, their stubbornness in relying on ponies instead of dogs and the fatal miscalculation of the distance between supply stacks on the way to the pole and back. There is a fantastic book about that by Roland Huntford called The Last Place on Earth, which is one of the best things I've read in a long time. Thanks for the recommendation. I might have to pick that up. I love me some survival stories. For, as Alison Albright noted, polar horror stories are the best. And especially in the case of those turn-of-the-last-century polar expeditions, you don't even need to add much to make them terrifying. Ugh. They're already full of polar bears, starvation, scurvy, mutiny, madness, and cannibalism. Ugh. The result is that any fictional terror you add on has to be really awful and bizarre to even register.
Yeah.
Yeah, true. I agree. It's like that movie, The Descent. I'm like, man, you already got me with people trapped in caves. You don't need to add cave creatures on top of it.
Let's move on to the Bells of Oceania. Shoggoth Lord writes, ah, yes, mermaids, one of the most iconic Celtic fae. They lure men to the abyss so they could be kept as slaves in golden chains on the sea floor. A shame they aren't around. Nowadays, they'd find no dearth of people actually into that. As per the vagueness of the tale, I have an idea. Though I haven't read it, so the writing may contradict it in some way. This seems to me a mental or spiritual threat, the kind of thing with no physical effect save it taking you, should it manage to do so. The guards may well have been going about their business without the faintest idea of what was closing in on them. Because the narrator was asleep, though, he was engaging in an age-old human pastime that is oft ascribed a mystic or spiritual dimension, dreaming.
Yeah.
And so he dreamed of the ship and the captain and the guards, but here he saw the drama play out with the predator in full view. He woke up, managing to escape the beast's clutches, of course. The captain didn't remember him because, to him, none of that happened. He spent the night quite awake. The only souls who could elucidate the matter at all, of course, were those two who disappeared. So.
That's a fairly good justification of why he couldn't, you know, nobody remembered what had happened at the end. I think that might be right. He also notes, oh, Chad, you said something massively inaccurate. The crew on Shackleton's expedition didn't die one by one. None of them died. That mad, magnificent bastard didn't lose a single man during their trip to icy perdition. Yeah, I was mixing things up. When I recall something without having gone back to look, I often will be inaccurate about it. So sorry about that. No, Shackleton was very successful in getting everybody back on that expedition. So many others ended in madness and death and horror, but no, that one came out not perfectly okay, but...
No, but we're pretty good.
But with a 100% survival. Make America Great Old Ones Again writes, I love it when suspension of disbelief comes crashing down. Weird pale face framed with seaweed outside the porthole. Disbelief suspended. Boat pursued by an island of seaweed. All good on the suspended disbelief front. Nude lady luring men to their death with promises of sweet, sweet, sweets and the tinkling of bells. We're good so far as the disbelief and suspension paradigm. Snake-bottomed lady leaves footprints despite having no feet and the deck being covered in storm water. Oh, a bridge too far, my friends. Disbelief, I regret to inform you, has come a crashing down. Yeah, that's so true.
It's true, yeah.
Yeah. Some things I find, you know, unreasonable for whatever reason, and other things I'm just willing to accept. Josh Decker writes, definitely it was Daryl Hannah. That's how you explain the wet footprints.
Of course. So now because when she got dry, she grew legs, and when she was wet, she turned into a mermaid.
So that's all been explained now. Thanks.
Easily sorted. Clint Page writes, so is it me, or are these sirens not sirens at all? Surely some of you good folk know what an anglerfish is, right? For those of you who don't, it's a fish with a projection extending from the top of its head that acts like a lure to attract prey. I think those sirens are just part of a much larger sea monster, probably a psychic one like the horror Martin's Beach, that can appear as whatever the Marines in the story desire most. In their case, the perfect sweetheart, right? Hmm. Or it just evolved projections that look like pretty ladies when you're lonely on the sea. Oh, gosh, that's pretty gross.
Yeah.
I can't explain much else about the story, but I think that part's right.
I really like that idea.
That's kind of, that's
it's
really
just
disturbing.
Bait. Yeah, it's not. That's not the creature at all.
Oh. Ooh. Agreeing with Clint's comment is Forrest Rush. For no particular reason, I had the image of the mermaid, especially the last one that was described as having a long, snake body as being the bait, tentacle-like on an anglerfish, but of some monstrous Chthonian entity. So the footprints could have been made by another set of tentacles that just have a pair of human feet dangling off of them.
Oh, man.
Horrific and funny, but I really liked the story, even if it wasn't always clear. It was so much better than that Rube Goldberg House of Infinite Ball Bearings.
Yeah, that story was terrible. That's crazy if it just had the tentacles with human feet dangling off of them. It's not supported in the story, really, but I love
that.
No,
but that's a very... Ugh.
It is funny to me. It kind of reminds me I don't know exactly why, but, you know, Top Secret, that crazy airplane, like Val Kilmer movie. There's the scene where he's crawling along the ground, and then suddenly there's boots in front of him, and he's all scared, and he slowly tracks up, and it's just a pair of boots. There's nobody standing him at all. It's such a great visual gag. Julianne Wack writes, Lorelei. You were right. The Lorelei is a rock mountain in Germany. Cool. I wasn't wrong about that. However, the Lorelei is also a sort of siren figure based on Clemens Brentano's Kunstsagen, which are told like a myth, although a tragic one. In some iterations of the story, she kills herself by jumping off the rock Lorelei after being falsely accused of witchcraft.
Oh.
It turned into folklore because the rapids around Lorelei were very dangerous and people heard weird echoes coming from the mountain, which were probably just very normal echoes. Perfect folklore fodder. She's like a beautiful mermaid with a great voice who just wants to sing her tunes and inadvertently distracts shipmen from staying on course. A bit like singing along to Beyonce really loud in the car, trying to hit that high note on Halo and swerving into a tree.
Oh, no.
Jeez. Well, I guess we've all done that. I actually had to sing that Heinrich Heine poem in school, and it's especially torture for boys going through puberty because it's a very high melody and very hard to sing. So in a way, even nowadays, the Lorelei drags young men into despair. Well, I love this idea of the accidental siren. You know,
all right, yeah.
I'm just out here doing my thing. I don't understand why my people keep crashing. This is not what I want to have happen.
Right.
Probably how the Beatles must have felt with all those young girls just screaming and tearing at their hair and beating on their skulls. You know, it is a little scary to me whenever I see footage like that. Like
a little scary. It's totally horrific.
It's
to
pretty.
Me.
Yeah. I mean, if you
what
just
is going on with
what's
those
going
people?
On with
understand.
Everybody?
Like yeah. I was into stuff when I was a teenager, but not like that. Nothing that would make me scream out loud.
Scream and cry and hit myself.
Oh my God. Were they like just so repressed that that's what was going on? Like the sexuality in them just had to come out in that bizarre way? Is that what it was?
Man, I don't know. I mean, people do act all kinds of crazy at concerts, and I appreciate it and love it. I mean, even the act of dancing is a little silly if you step back and look at it. But that kind of self-flagellation, it's got some kind of religious undertones to it or something. You know?
Dancing makes sense. I mean, I could feel the groove and want to dance. That's something that I experienced. Mm-hmm. But I've never, like, saw a celebrity or a band and just gone, like, no, it's never happened. In fact, there's nothing in my life. Like, the best things that have happened in my life, like my children being born, never made me do that. Marrying my wife.
Oh, man.
No, nothing like that.
Oh, but it's a funny reaction to a non-rock and roll thing, right? Like, just get a great hot dog. Oh, God! On to the moon pool.
Yes, moon pool.
Which was a two-parter. Part one, Andrew M. Reichart writes, nice little in-joke with the moon bog music, Chad, except I kept expecting that mad piping jig to start. Oh, thank you for recognizing. Yeah, I used a pad that I used back in that show.
Wow, and, well done.
Yeah,
Pfeiffer and Andrew.
He called it out. Thanks.
Frank Bailey writes, I was so happy to hear that there was a shorter version until I realized I was reading the shorter version.
Oh, no.
Oh, sorry,
that's
Frank.
The horror in the story.
Yeah. Like you guys, I think there were some neat ideas, but geez, get to the point. I think this might be one I could like if I were in the right mood, but it's wearing on me. We'll probably let the boys finish this one for me. Hey, that's our job, man.
Yeah, we'll do it. There weren't a lot of comments on that episode, actually, so let's get into part two, where there were a lot more. Lee Lyons wrote on Moonpool Part 2, you guys have given me so much pleasure over the years. I thank you so much. I love your intelligent, thoughtful, intimate commentary, but sometimes it's comments like, Boon Companions? She was really more Boon Curious. Make my day.
That was a good one, Pfeiffer.
It didn't land during recording, so I wasn't sure. You know, we just kind of went past it, and I thought, well, all right, mediocre joke, I get it. So that's
it was funnier. Well, so sometimes when we're doing the show, I just like I'm thinking about what I'm going to say next.
Oh, for sure,
me and
too.
I'm not listening.
Yeah.
But when I listened to it after it was edited, that made me laugh out loud.
Good. Well,
so
I love
good job.
You. Thank you, everybody, because Boon Curious is really funny. Steve writes, I'm afraid someone got to it before you and sends a link to avocado toast with pineapple.
Oh.
Remember, that was what I was saying the avaloha would be. And,
oh, right, yes.
Maybe they got to it before me, but clearly you haven't been to JCPenney recently, where I'm also demoing my avaloha avocado toast. So,
oh, wow.
Well, JCP's where all the young people are hanging out these days. It's very millennial. Cool.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Wow.
People.
I'm really out of the loop.
Testing out perfume and checking out cute blouses and stuff. That's what all the millennials do. JCP, baby.
But aren't the millennials like now in their early 30s and late 20s?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Speaker in digressions writes, Doc Throck and Company's initial theory about a lunar-powered door is just ridiculous. Now, lunar-powered dwarf runes that tell you where to find the door, that's just science.
Sure is.
Meanwhile, the comments about how Call of Cthulhu RPG players would react to a lame glowing tornado remind me, as I'm sure you've discussed in the past, about the differences between Ascension of the game and Lovecraft's actual stories. I mean, imagine the disappointment when the Keeper reveals the climax of the story. Keeper, on the chair you see the face and hands of Henry Wentworth Akeley. Dramatic pause, and then the Keeper starts to pack up the rule books. PC1. Well, you be PC1, and I'll be PC2.
Okay, cool. Okay. I'm going to use Investigate to see if it's a mask or an actual human face.
Yeah, and meanwhile, I'm assuming that the thing that was wearing the mask is still around. Bob, let's you and me go check out the rest of the house. The Keeper. No, wait, you guys, it's his face and hands. You've been talking to an alien lobster fungus this whole time.
Yeah, obviously. Let's go find it and see if it's immune to bullets. That's exactly how that would go.
Nailed it.
Stephen Palmer writes, G'day from Oz. Love your show. I have been an avid listener for years. Great to hear Melbourne. It's pronounced Melbourne, by the way. Get a mention. I think we pronounce it all kinds of stupid ways.
Okay.
But yeah, Melbourne's the way that you're supposed to say it. You might enjoy a terrific novel called Grimoire by Kim Wilkins. It is set in my marvelous Melbourne, which is so gothic, it was founded by a bloke called Batman. Keep up the great work. And that is true. John Batman
is the
founder of Melbourne. Yes. In fact, the initial settlement was called Batmania at first. That's not a lie.
Are you serious?
I am dead serious. Look it up.
Oh, my God.
Melbourne was at one point, when it was just a settlement, it was called Batmania. I think the Melbourne comes from some English fellow that was ruling over the property.
That's crazy.
Well, I probably have talked about this before. I had a mechanic once when I lived in Hollywood. And, you know, there's a big Armenian population in that part of Los Angeles. And they all have those names that end with I-A-N. In fact, we'd say, you know, you could just throw any word in there and put I-A-N at the end of it, and it's an Armenian last name. And then I had a mechanic who was named Rafi Batmanian. And I thought, oh, come on. He's got to just be making that up. But it really was his name. And John Batman is the founder of Melbourne. Wow. So there you go.
So Evan J. Dove writes, so I'm not sure about anyone else, but this immediately made me think of The Abyss, the James Cameron film. Honestly, before you read the synopsis of the novel, at the very end of the episode, I found myself thinking along the lines that the figure in the moon pool might actually be an enlightened being. For all we know, the only thing it's providing is the ecstasy, and the horror on the people's faces is either a result of them realizing how shitty human existence is, or simply a gross misinterpretation by the witness due to it being a quite traumatic event. Seeing people you care about turned into floating light balls.
That might mess you up to see that.
Yeah, it's true. I'm wondering if perhaps this tale could be categorized more along the lines of just weird or theological sci-fi as opposed to the more cosmic horror-y stuff we're used to from Lovecraft. Because honestly, if you look at it, aside from the aforementioned expression of horror, the people don't appear to be in any pain. They're not winding up dead like the dudes who fell into the siren-esque things in The Bells. For all we know, they're just transcending our realm, and the experience is so awesome, hyphenated since awesome tends to have a much more simplified connotation these days, that the people witnessing it can't comprehend the knowledge, power, pure sexual bliss, or what have you, that those beings taken are experiencing.
Oh, that's a pretty interesting read of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you might be onto something there.
Yeah,
it is funny to call out awesome. I remember when I was a kid, I had a card from Star Wars and it said, "Here is the awesome Darth Vader." You know, and my understanding of that word was much different than what it actually is supposed to mean, which is somebody who fills you with awe.
Awe-inspiring,
that kind of cheapens him as a villain to call him awesome, you know? Not too awesome to me. He killed Ben Kenobi. Piers Duncan, to close out this section on the moon pool, simply wrote, "The moon poo." And I'm very juvenile, so I found that, very amusing.
Okay, let's hit Die Monster Die.
Right, we did some bonus content on Die Monster Die, and Shoggoth Lord writes, "A shame this one was a bore. Luckily, the next time you want to delve into Lovecraftian film coverage, you have at least one option that's rather good and fairly obscure. Cast a Deadly Spell, starring the appropriately hard-boiled Lovecraftian named Fred Ward. I'd love to hear you guys talk about that one." Well, I feel like we've talked about it a lot, haven't we?
I think we have. I love that movie.
Yeah.
I don't think it's very, even though there's a lot of Lovecraftian things in there, the tone of it is not really very Lovecraftian.
Yeah, but I watched it a million times.
I watched it over and over and over again. I loved it. That was how I was introduced to Julianne Moore. And then she got like more and more famous after that movie.
Sure. Yeah. And also the I sampled the whole end of that because David Warner goes on some amazing rants about the Outer Gods and Cthulhu and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. We sampled all that and used it in different songs. My band.
Oh, yeah.
So
it's great stuff.
We were definitely very into that movie. Yeah, maybe sometime if we do another Lovecraft movie, we'll cover that.
Yeah. I would just like talking about it.
It would be fun to watch again.
Eldridge Scary writes, I'm actually hoping you can now review the uncredited adaptation of The Color Out of Space from 1987, The Curse, starring Will Wheaton and Claude Akins. It's pretty true to the source material as well as ridiculous. And with Die Monster Die so fresh in your memories, it will be easy to compare and contrast. I have heard so much about this movie, and I have never seen it, and I'm always meant to.
Yeah, I've never seen it either. Maybe we'll have to check that one out. Good recommendation. Cacodemoniacal writes, Corman is a sort of Derleth to Poe, and to a lesser extent, Lovecraft. Only with Poe, he mostly kept the titles alive rather than the stories.
Hmm.
I think the creatures in the barn were Shoggoths, and we should be sincerely thankful they weren't ponies in body paint. Although this movie is hella bad, it's got great aesthetic. Maybe when you were a kid, you assume you just aren't getting what's going on, so the confusion adds rather than detracts. You are more willing to create a story in your head to explain it to yourself. As an adult, your head hurts and you want to demand an apology. Certainly, there are a lot of movies that I couldn't get through now that when I was a kid and caught them on cable, I just watched.
Sure.
The bar for what was good or not good was much lower when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the movie did have a great aesthetic. Like, it looked really cool and the sets were really great. But
yeah.
Jeff C. Carter, fighting his way onto this show again.
He did it again.
At what Patreon level will you make a Manimal podcast? I need me some more hot Manimal talk.
I don't know. Maybe we should do a Manimal as a bonus episode at some point.
Should we just all of Manimal? Discuss? Or just pick an episode of Manimal?
We'd have to pick an episode, yeah.
And just get, God, because there's so much Manimal. The one that sticks in my mind is the one where he learns martial arts by watching the animals.
Yeah, that would be what it is, I think.
Yeah, that's got James Hong in it, I believe.
It does. And the martial arts sequences, mwah, they're so good. Yeah, we might have to cover that one at some point. It's a laugh riot.
Ryan Dawson writes, y'all killing me with the pronunciation. Nam is said like Nahum or like Mayhem with an N, or possibly Nahum, but not Nam. Oh. It's two syllables, long ah. Yeah, we were saying it wrong. It's not.
I wasn't saying it wrong. You were saying it wrong.
Nom?
I didn't say it at all. I go, well, I don't remember if you're right. Because we had this whole conversation back when we covered the story, and I didn't remember where we landed on it, so I just avoided saying the name entirely.
Oh, that was good.
So you're the one that got busted.
I'm not very smart.
Comments show 12. We're talking Omniscient Chris Lackey, or at least that's what I titled it. By the way, I recently posted an excerpt from our old Strategies bonus show. It was about 2 minutes long, and you perfectly explained that plot twist in the last season of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And we were not talking about Game of Thrones.
No.
This was months ago. But you explained quite concisely, I thought, what would happen if you gained the level of power that Daenerys has in that show. Not making that comparison, but if you were super powerful, how you would try to get counselors to sort things out for you. But if somebody killed me, you'd destroy their whole, you know, town or city or whatever. And I thought all that was what happened to the show. So it was really funny, as much as people were complaining. I don't know, kind of made sense to us.
It did.
Forrest Rush writes, a power-corrupted, fickle Dr. Lackey would still be better than a lot of what passes for self-rule and self-determination, even in these arguably more progressive times.
Hmm.
Now, are you Dr. Lackey just because you're omnipotent and you made them give you that doctorate?
I threatened universities and say, look, if you don't give me a doctorate, I'm going to destroy.
Oh, so corrupted. Forrest continues, I just see the inevitable outcome being that of the end of Watchmen, namely you get fed up and split for another galaxy.
Right. Now, I just want to say something, though. If was omnipotent and becoming evil, I wouldn't do that.
You wouldn't demand a doctorate?
I wouldn't force anybody to call me doctor. That's ridiculous.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Okay.
Yeah.
Forrest continues, while I love Gaiman and Adams and virtually all stories about gods, I tend to think the more likely outcome of a deity is not needing to control or help humans, but to get as far away from them as possible. I think, Chris, after the umpteenth time of you having to fix something on your Venusian paradise, you'll just throw your hands up and scream in exasperation. How many times do I have to tell you guys or show you how to be a little frickin' decent to one another?
Oh, boy.
Might be a point.
Yeah. I hope you're not right, Forrest, but something about that kind of rings true. Sebastian Tenewo writes, I would like to see the creation of the Boon Companion Dollar Whisper Club. It's exactly like the Dollar Whisper Club, but instead there are two people who whisper in unison, and at the end of every whisper they say, for we are boon companions.
Well, I like your ambition. I would say you're diversifying the Dollar Whisper Club business a little too early, maybe.
Oh, okay.
You know, you want to stick to what your core competency is, and when you start adding in the boon companion stuff, might be too much growth too fast.
Boy, that's a service I would pay for, though.
You'd like that?
There's a demand. Oh, yeah, for sure. People have two guys, and then at the end of whatever they whisper, they say, for we are boon companions. That's gold.
You know, well, maybe we'll put up a little kiosk at the JCP and run a little pilot program and see how that works out.
Oh, boy. Make America Great Old Ones Again writes, so glad to finally be caught up. I always appreciate the work you gents do. Oh, thank you so much. I think if you're going to create a good Venus, you're really just not willing to do the real work. I mean, leaving an Earth filled with shitty people is essentially condemning them to a horrible existence. So why not just kill them? Sure, it seems harsh, but in many ways, it's more humane. Burn out the cancer and let's get going on a nice, healthy, and solidly good body politic. Well, see, the whole thing about me and making Venus is its own planet is that I don't have to force my will on anybody that's not willing to have it done to them. So, like... Mm-hmm. I've got all this power, and if I started messing around with Earth, a lot of people would get upset and feel like they're being controlled, which they would be. But if I was like, okay, I've made Venus. If you want to come live on my planet, you got to follow my rules. But you'll get healthcare, you'll get your own land, you'll get fed, you'll get all these things. That's the deal. By making Venus a separate place where people can come, I can kind of try and maintain being a good person without messing up Earth. Now, anybody would be welcome to come to my utopian Venus. Like, the doors are open. Anybody who wants to come there can. But, of course, you don't get to bring your money with you. You don't get to bring most of your stuff. You know, it's like, it's a completely sure. different system that would exist there.
I will say, though, at some point, these justifications of yours are getting... what's the point? It doesn't matter who you are arguing with. You're the omnipotent one.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
You don't have to justify anything you do. So as long as you got it worked out in your head, that's fine. Like, I'm listening to this right now going, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But then I'm going, it doesn't really matter. Because if you change your mind about all of it, I'm going to have to do whatever that is too. Because you're, you know?
It's true, yeah.
So it's not like there's some court of public opinion that you have to be. You're still doing old human things you don't need to do.
I know, yeah.
Allison Albright writes, I'd still sign on to Omniscient Chris Lackey's experimental Venusian paradise. Chris seems so nice that even at his most evil, he'd still be more good than the people running things on Earth these days. Oh. Evil Chris. You still get a place to live and food and medicine and freedom from exploitation and suffering, but sometimes you have to circle the block a bit to find parking. Spins around in his chair and strokes a hairless cat in his lap.
Oh, wow. Hairless. Why is it hairless?
Exactly. You're still letting that cat be bald, which is cruel.
Oh.
Especially when my new line of feline hair pieces is rolling out at the JCP. It's going to be there next month. No cats need be bald.
What? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really missing out on JCPenney's. I didn't realize that was... I didn't even realize they were still open. I thought they all closed down.
Well, yeah, as a brand, it's dying out. But this is... I'm, you know, infusing it with new life. I'm going to reinvent the shopping mall. It's going to be all dog tuck stores, feline hair pieces, and... Dollar Whisper Clubs.
James Duffy writes, having spent the last 10 years working for a police force in southern England and seeing the stuff that goes on, it makes you rather cynical about humanity.
Types of
slavery might have gone away, but if you saw the vast numbers of cases being dealt with where people are being trafficked around the world and forcibly used for everything from basic manual labor to drug running to prostitution, you'd realize it's more prevalent than people like to consider. And that's also ignoring the growing economic inequalities and reduction in pay and conditions for workers that is seeing many shifting into corporate slavery situations where they are bound to certain work roles, whether they like it or not, due to the massive restrictions in their options and social mobility.
He continues, then there are the simmering racism, sexism, and other hate-related matters that often seem as though they have receded, yet come bursting back out the moment people think they can reveal their true selves. After the Brexit vote, I had to deal with much more such incidents than I ever had before, and they've still not gone away. And domestic violence that regularly still happens behind closed doors. Society may purport to not accept it, but it still goes on. Mm. The world may look better on the surface, but underneath, it's still a seething mess of rancidness.
Wow.
People have just learned how to adapt and hide what goes on, to alter the patterns and ways they behave and conduct their activities. Oof. Venus would just end up the same way, or nuked by those you left behind. And you know the rich and powerful would do everything they could to either to escape there themselves or to ship away those they deem unworthy, leaving the Earth itself as their playground. And now I'd better stop before I start sounding like Rory Rorschach. Yeah, there's a lot of Watchmen stuff running through all of this, huh?
You know, I'd like to think that there wouldn't be a power inequality on Venus. I would keep thinking, I mean, the power inequality would exist, obviously, because all the power would be in my hand.
Yeah, that's a pretty big inequality, man.
But within everybody else, people, things would be pretty even. You know, there wouldn't be this really huge
if you
amount.
Like being a, if you like being a slave, you're right.
They're not a slave. They don't have to do anything. Just be nice to each other.
Just exactly what you tell them to do. That's what they have to do.
Well,
you're right. All you have to do is exactly what I say.
Exactly what I say, which I think is not much to really ask of anybody.
Sure.
Be nice to each other. Crying out loud.
Stop telling me what to do.
Jaws's Tin Man writes, great show as usual. I liked your points about the artificiality of the trolley problem. I think people try to read way too much into folks' responses to it. Of course, the only decision-making test that counts is the Kobayashi Maru. Yeah! Right.
How do you deal with defeat is the true test of your character. Unless you're a cheater like Captain Kirk. Who just refuses to deal with defeat.
He does. And I think that's a good place to leave our comment show for comments from the month of April.
It is a good place to leave off. You guys have given us a lot to think about, as always. You are wonderful listeners, and I love the things that you have to say. I love this conversation that we're having over the months and years, and hopefully you keep writing in on these shows, because
you guys are awesome. Thank you for taking the time to write comments, and they're all fun and interesting. And if we didn't get to your comment, don't give up. Keep writing stuff, and we'll get to it. We can't read all the comments, obviously, because there's so many of them.
There's a lot of great ones, though, so it's also good to go and read them on your own. But yes. Yeah, don't stop believing. We'll get you on eventually. That's all we have for this week. Thanks so much. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast Comment Show, only on Patreon.
Exclusive.
HPPodcraft.com.